The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, sometimes some people think it's justified to lie. And I'm not talking about just our kids when, you know, we had a pretty fierce punishment for lying as our kids were growing up, and they still remember that. But, you know, I'm thinking about finance ministers in Europe saying sometimes it's appropriate.
Yeah, so the topic today is a familiar one. You've got the European financial minister some time ago, Jean-Claude Juncker, who said, when it becomes serious, you have to lie. And that is, in fact, what we suspect from the Fed. That's what we think is happening today with the Fed as they attempt to manage or, frankly, manipulate market expectations. You know, we have information flows from the Fed, and they're designed to influence market behavior and not necessarily express really the heart and mind of the Fed's governing board. Again, we assume that what they release is what they're actually thinking, and it should be, correct?
Right.
Except that you have to go back to that issue of extraordinary circumstances, redefining what is ethically acceptable. And again, we're talking about a difference between a European finance minister and a U.S. finance minister. Perhaps it's not fair to assume that the Fed would consider lying a real alternative, but we do know that we're looking at extraordinary measures. We're looking at interest rates, which have been held low for 5 years. We're looking at, again, the kind of stimulus, not only here in the United States, but around the world, that's unparalleled in modern times in terms of modern finance. And so to see these radical actions having been taken and forget that these are not only extraordinary measures, but represent very dire circumstances which necessitated them, we would be wrong to assume that the Fed doesn't have some flexibility, some play, if you will, in how they interpret truthfulness or lack thereof. What is appropriate in terms of truth speaking?
Well, and you know, you have to put yourself in their shoes and then put yourself back in your own shoes. Okay, if you're in their shoes and you think, all right, if I told the truth right now and I told everyone that we were shrinking, not growing as an economy without the $85 billion, and that interest rates were artificially being held down but would be much higher if we were actually paying for the true risk, I'm sitting here thinking, okay, if I'm Ben Bernanke and I actually say that, then we're going to have a crash. You know, it reminds me, Dave, of the paradox, okay, of the person who says, everything I say is a lie. Well, if he's telling the truth, then everything he says is a lie. But you see the paradox there. Now, put yourself back in our own shoes as investors, as people who have to survive this management, this manipulation. What do we do if we do assume the Federal Reserve is lying?
We've got the Fed in a classic liquidity trap with a market that has grown overdependent on the supply of money and credit from the central bank. And really what that does is it makes the market consequences to a change in course. That is, you know, if they tighten policy, if they restrict the bond purchases or limit them or taper them, as they've liked to call them recently,
right,
they could be looking at catastrophic consequences as a result. So, I mean, the stakes are higher today than in past periods. And I think this is where we can step back from the current circumstances and say, loose credit, that's not new.
No, we can look back at history and see loose credit go terribly wrong over and over.
But under the gold standard, loose credit created banking problems. And this is kind of what David Stockman described several weeks ago. You know, if you have a banking problem, it should burn out, how did he say, in the canyons of Wall Street or
right,
in the banking community. In other words, you're not looking at a lot of collateral damage, and it certainly shouldn't edge into the larger economy. The difference today, and this is what Paul Meisen has noted, he's an academic that I like to read, he's noted that the banking crisis and subsequent currency crises are today inseparable.
So it's no longer the banks. We all use currency today.
But that is a consequence of moving away from the gold standard. So
right,
now you have, no different than what we've had in any other period in history, loose monetary policies leading to a banking crisis. But the difference is, without a credibility anchor,
like gold, right,
the banking crisis spills into a broader currency crisis. And the issue there is that you now are implicating every depositor and every currency participant, if you can call them that. I mean, if you've got bank deposits, if you've got, you know, coins or shekels in your pocket, we're talking about you.
Well, and you know, it's interesting, David, we're seeing people having to share responsibility for things that they never created in the first place. You're talking about currency here, but even look at Cyprus, you know, 7-8 weeks ago when we had the confiscation of deposits to pay back debt. people right now don't really realize how many different ways they can lose. But the currency crisis, this is the one that Keynes talked about being the sneakiest of all. You know, it's one that one in a million people understand, but they're really losing a tremendous amount of value.
And the question is it controlled? And again, that's sort of the orchestrated decline. We'll talk a little bit about that. But the real crisis would be if they lose control. And this is where we see the plot thickening over the next 6, 12, 18 months.
Are you talking about interest rates actually rising?
Yeah, and exactly. If you go back to the Barings crisis, you know, Argentina, we were dealing with some external events and trade relationships. Argentina, all of a sudden, was at the sort of end of
a huge boom.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Then you had interest rates rise from about 4 to 6%. This marginal increase in interest rates in your various money centers around the world caused major problems in Argentina, which caused major problems for a particular bank. Barings barely made it through that
period. Which was in England across the Atlantic. And we're talking about a century ago, David. What we're talking about is not instant information day. We're talking about 100 years ago it caused a banking crisis.
And
now
so
we're more interconnected.
That's just one illustration of when interest rates move, and not catastrophically. I mean, to move from 4 to 6%, we're not talking about a spike of 6, 8, 10% sort of from zero to those levels, but even just a marginal increase caused institutional compromise in terms of their safety, integrity, ability to operate, etc.
Well, okay, now let me ask you a question, though, because we're getting so used to zero interest rates that it's as if they'll never go up again. What would precipitate a rise in interest rates? I mean, would it be a market crash? Would it be a market boom? Tell me what would cause a rise in interest rates at this point.
Well, at this point, it would be completely natural for rates to rise, only because we have them set artificially low. In the U.S., I mean, it's not something strange that will raise interest rates. It's just the bank stepping away, that is the central bank stepping away and not purchasing $45 billion worth of treasuries a month, artificially keeping rates lower. I mean, it's like asking if you hold a basketball underneath the water, what is going to cause it to rise?
Right.
It's only natural that it finds equilibrium at a higher level and maybe even goes higher still. That sort of Newt Wicksell's idea of if you keep interest rates too low for too long, ultimately they go higher than you ever expected them to.
That's an interesting analogy. If you've ever tried to sit on a basketball underwater, okay.
You expect it to hit the waterline?
No, in fact,
it goes further.
Watch your chin.
Yeah. Well, and so you have the thought of rising rates and the consequence in various equity markets. That was on display last week. We had the Nikkei sell off very hard, a 7% downdraft in a single day. And that was a healthy reminder of how quickly one trend, the seemingly unstoppable growth trend, can be turned on a dime and move in the opposite direction.
Right.
So, I mean, from the Thursday peak to the Friday close in the Japanese stock market, you had a decline of 12.3%. And there's this growing awareness that the Bank of Japan may not be able to keep rates under control.
Right.
Why does this matter? Well, I mean, you look at the nation's banks in Japan, and they have 43% of government bonds on their balance sheets. 43% of Japanese government bonds sit in the capital structures of your Japanese banks. So what do you think happens to the value of those bonds as interest rates goes higher?
That's the one way that you crush a bond price.
And so what happens to Japanese banks, which have done very well in terms of their trading? A number of months ago, I owned Japanese banks personally and sold them, looking at this and saying, you know, I don't know that this is going to end well. Maybe I sold too soon. But following Meyer Amschel's advice, that's probably the better time to sell is too soon. What we see is a major catastrophe in the making there in Japan, potentially here in the United States as well. This is the issue. It's essentially game over in Japan when the general markets recognize that the Bank of Japan's not in charge anymore. And you have two things that happen. I mean, one, you have further depreciation in the yen, 20-40%. But two, you've got this sort of rate crush. I mean, remember that our government and the Japanese government are in debt up to their eyeballs. Japan, obviously, even more so than we are. And the interest component, this is the real critical component. The interest component on the debt is the key variable to either solvency or non-solvency. Because again, you look at the amount of debt, and you know, the Reinhardt and Rogoff study showed that if it's 90% of debt to GDP, you're moving into a red zone and potentially there could be a real problem in the future. And yet, we've suspended reality in Japan, where they have well over 200, almost 250% debt to GDP, and yet they're fine. Why are they fine? Because they've been able to keep interest rates so low. Thus, the interest component compared to the total economy is still manageable. But that means that should they lose control of the interest component, that is, interest rates, it's game over.
Well, and I think we should put in perspective, Dave, I mean, Back 20, 25 years ago, a 1% increase in interest was nothing because interest rates were 13, 14, 15%. So 1%, it's like, okay, well, that's not that big a deal. A 1% interest rate increase here in the United States is like doubling what we're paying in interest. Another percent after that. I mean, what we're talking about is huge compounding. We can't, well, I should say, we can pay our debt right now with the zero interest rates. We have been. We've been paying the interest on the debt. What you're saying, though, is if it just goes up a couple of percent, we're really going to be damaged, and Japan's in the same position.
They're in the same position indeed. So, again, when interest rates become too large as a percentage of total revenue, there is this reappraisal of the economy as a whole. And investors look at the currency as a representation of that economy very differently. So perhaps we should reverse those two. We mentioned earlier where essentially, you know, the market forces the yen or dollar devaluation, and that follows on the heels of an interest rate moving higher. In any event, you've got the slower but sort of constant, what you were talking about earlier, Kevin, the orchestrated devaluation, that's going to continue regardless as a consequence of central bank intervention in the bond market. That's what we call monetization and sort of the death of the currency by 1,000 paper cuts. They're not actually printing money to go out and buy bonds. It's just credit created on a bank ledger somewhere.
Okay, so what follows that, though, David? I mean, what's next beyond currency weakness and bond market revolt? Because we've been talking about a reversal in the bond market. We're finally hearing from the guys who, that's their life, like the Bill Grosses of the world, saying, you know what? I don't like bonds anymore.
Yep, Japanese banks, industrial firms. I mean, if we're talking about Japan, Japanese banks, industrial firms with very leveraged balance sheets, they're equally vulnerable. And what we're dealing with is the cost of capital. On the one hand, a cheaper currency delivers an export advantage. That's what the managers of the Japanese and the U.S. economy have long argued.
Sure, Toyotas are going to be cheaper this year.
And you don't want to sort of stir a currency war by devaluing too aggressively. But on the other hand, you deliver an export advantage. And there is a simple assumption that you're going to improve the trade balance. Actually, that may not be the case. You could actually see it deteriorate in the case of Japan. Remember that the U.S. is very resource rich. Why do the Japanese go to war? Have they gone to war in the past?
Right. It's resources. They don't have them.
They don't have them, and they need them. So Japan is in a poor position by comparison. They can gain an export advantage, you know, but again, you've got the rising input costs, which take away a lot of the advantage for exporters. In other words, they're basically squeezing margins. So whatever is gained over here is lost over there. Mm. Arguably, U.S. dollar devaluation delivers more of a competitive advantage with many of our natural resources sourced locally and thus on a delivered basis cheaper. We don't have to import natural gas or oil to the degree that Japan does, where you're talking about 100% need.
Well, you know, David, there's this expectation, though, that things are going to just continue the way they are. I was explaining an amplifier to my son, and he actually knew more about them than I did. But, you know, a feedback loop is interesting because when you're trying to amplify a sound, you send that sound through the circuit once, and then you amplify it a little bit, and then you bring it back and loop it again, and you loop it again. What happens is that sound becomes very loud. In fact, sometimes you'll hear that feedback loop when a microphone goes to that squeal that everybody hates. All that is this feedback of the same sound. Now, the expectation in the market is zero interest rates. Okay, now maybe everyone will nod their head and say, yeah, someday they'll go up. But the expectation and the way people are investing is a feedback loop in a way, is it not?
Yeah, no, it's a very self-justifying logic in the market. In the end, it's circular in nature. The market is up, therefore the market is healthy and should go up further. The next move higher justifies the next move higher, and on it goes.
Right.
And you see the same thing today in Japan and in the U.S. You know, today you've got real estate investment trusts in Japan, even this week. A strong rally signifies that Abenomics is still working and people still believe that the Bank of Japan is going to deliver. Well, what are we talking about here? We're talking about the Bank of Japan pledging to buy real estate investment trusts in Japan, and then the general public says, well, if they're buying, then we should buy because they're going to drive the price up. And then as soon as the price is driven up, people start saying, well, the price is going up, therefore it must be sort of a good time to be buying, and we'll buy more. And that sort of self-perpetuating momentum, you have to step back and say, hey, wait a minute. We are talking about a completely artificial boost. The Bank of Japan has chosen asset classes to boost the economy, quote-unquote, Whether it does that is a very secondary issue. It is boosting asset prices, just as we've seen in the United States. This week, we've got U.S. house prices rising more than any other time in the last 7 years. What does this signify? Is it a recovery in housing, or are we actually looking at the same kind of thing, this amplification of central bank policy? As much as I'd like to believe that it is simply a recovery in housing and a floor being put in and a recovery in employment, et cetera, you can't step away from the fact that 100% of the mortgage-backed securities market is being funded by the Fed.
Right.
The Fed is purchasing their $40 billion, not the $45 billion they're putting into treasuries each month, but the $40 billion they're putting into the mortgage-backed securities market. They are the mortgage-backed securities market. Take away the Fed, you take away the mortgage-backed securities market, you take away the entire mortgage market. Now how are you doing?
Well,
so again, you've got that, as you described, a positive feedback loop, but it's really somewhat ephemeral.
Well, and what you talked about, you use the word momentum. And Dave, sometimes you'll use that word, and I think it's important that we key on it sometimes so we understand the difference between a fundamental move or a long-term secular move or just a momentum move. And this momentum move is very similar to this feedback loop. In other words, when a price rises or falls based on just other people buying and selling because of the momentum, like you're saying, this feedback, that never really lasts. It doesn't change the overall trend. And so the momentum right now is pushing things up over there, but the actual trend is probably down.
And here's where the danger lies. The weakness in logic is tested when good reasons for selling enter the market, and all of a sudden you have rational selling, you have profit taking, you have, call it a basic reassessment of risk. And I think this is the real critical variable here. The idea of risk reassessment is one we need to keep in mind. It's a very powerful thing when risk wasn't being adequately accounted for in the first place. Again, when someone steps into the market and starts buying just on the basis of everyone else buying, on the basis of positive momentum. I mean, again, if Bank of Japan's buying REITs, we should buy REITs. The price of REITs is going up, therefore we should buy more REITs because the price continues to go higher in this sort of self-perpetuating cycle. But again, you're not asking questions of risk appraisal. If they are asked, now all of a sudden you have a complete recalibration of the entire schematic.
So not to completely capitalize on Japan, the U.S. circumstances, like you were saying, may be similar. You were talking about real estate equities, buoyant prices. You're talking about the Fed buying 100% of the mortgage-backed securities. That's not reality. It's not reality.
It's not reality, and it's very important that people appreciate the volatility in the Japanese equity market last week as something of a foreshadowing of exactly what we can have here
for the United States.
In the U.S. equities market.
Yeah.
The Fed's buying 100% of mortgage-backed securities market. They're essentially subsidizing the mortgage market, holding rates below a normal level, what we call equilibrium. And similarly, you've got equity investors. This includes both retail investors and professional asset managers alike that are offered an inexpensive means of speculating.
Free money.
Via record low rates.
Yeah.
Okay, the most recent margin numbers bear this out. You have a new all-time high in terms of margin numbers, $384 billion. Last time we reported $379, just under the 2007 peak. Now we're over the 2007 peak, highest numbers we've ever seen in terms of margin.
Well, and a margin, just to remind the listener, a margin is you're owning something you don't own. You're borrowing money to basically own more of whatever you're investing in.
And I think it's very important to remember that leveraged bets are temporary bets. You are using borrowed money, and the trade is always on borrowed time, which is to say you've got $384 billion in borrowed money for purchasing stock, which ultimately becomes at least $384 billion of liquidations in the future. Mm-hmm. I mean, so it's the more that's there, yes, it perpetuates this sense of euphoria, but it is more like the sword of Damocles. It's just hanging there by a thread. Now, you're merely exaggerating. This is what I'm saying. You're exaggerating today's audience when you have this sort of $384 billion of purchases today. You're exaggerating the audience who's buying. There's not that many players. You're just increasing the footprint by the few players that are still in the market.
Right. Well, and they're only there, David, because of low interest rates. If interest rates, playing this little mind experiment that we're talking about, which is possibility of higher interest rates, if interest rates come up at all, that free money is no longer free. That leverage doesn't look as good.
Exactly. So as rates rise, leveraged players are affected, and investors may unknowingly be trapped in a losing proposition. So, I mean, specifically, the sectors likely to come under pressure are REITs, your real estate investment trusts. These are highly leveraged. You've got high dividend companies. Again, they're low in terms of their payout in historical terms, but today people have moved into high dividend paying companies because the payouts are high relative to treasuries and bank deposits.
Well, you can't earn interest, Dave. That's why people are buying utilities right now. They at least need the dividend for the income.
So we see that sort of reversal around the corner, and most dramatically so from the income generators. You've got your utilities, which in April traded to 22.9 times earnings. You've got your low volatility stocks, which became very popular and will probably be a misnomer. We could call them the high volatility stocks of tomorrow, given the fact that in April they were trading at 24.9 times earnings.
Well, and let's put that in perspective. Anytime you get up around 18, 19, 20, you're
it's
getting
rich.
Ready for, yeah.
It's rich. Now, it doesn't mean it can't get richer, but it does mean that you're not buying a value. And again, low volatility may become the new high volatility.
Right.
Utilities generally viewed as a safe bet and a good income generator, they're interest rate sensitive.
Mm-hmm.
They're interest rate sensitive. And as a money market rate begins to compete with a dividend rate or a utility rate or a REIT rate where you're taking more risk for that old reward, all of a sudden you say to yourself, why couldn't I just sit in cash and earn the same return? And all of a sudden you see, again, selling precipitated. So the point being 2.5%, while it's compelling today, and that's the primary reason for a lot of investors moving out of their usual savings positions and into the equity markets, what's happening is that your cash equivalent money market or short-term CD, as it goes back to 2.5%, there's no reason for you to take the risks that you've accepted in a highly manipulated environment. So the risk inherent to the equity market, if it's not reasonable, then the capital reallocation is, again, back in play.
Well, David, you know, we've looked at for years in banks the concept of hot money. And hot money is just money that doesn't really have long-term loyalty. It's somewhere because they're getting a little better interest rate. And as you go bank by bank by bank, you can see, you know, one bank paying a few hundredths of a point higher than another. And so you'll see a lot of money there that won't be there the second that another bank is paying more. And it sounds to me like what we've done is we've converted hot money not just from bank to bank, but we've turned people who would normally be long-term investors for income into hot money investors because they're just having to move anywhere they can squeeze out that last little bit of money.
Yep, so it's really a recharacterization of the investor who would be a quote-unquote hot money investor or a temporary investor. We think of hot money in general terms. That's a short-term speculative commitment. You know, it's more common with a hedge fund or a special opportunity fund chasing a high rate of return. That sort of characterizes hot money. Looking for the highest rate of return, no sense of long-term loyalty, just there for the sake of the higher rate of return. And this can sometimes be sort of arbitrage involved where you're talking about a yen carry trade or the US dollar carry trade where you're borrowing short-term at a very low interest rate and then investing for that higher yield someplace else. So not just looking for the higher yield, but doing it with someone else's money on a borrowed or leveraged basis.
Well, an arbitrage market is a very high-speed market that moves from here to there, but you can't bet your farm on arbitrage money.
And it's always on a temporary basis. It's
right.
Temporary by nature, particularly when you bring leverage into the equation. That's ultimately money that has to be paid back, and that initial trade or investment has to be unwound. So money in becomes money out, and that's what can become destabilizing.
Right.
Money in for the wrong reasons. And that's what we're seeing now is a variety of asset classes where money is coming in for the wrong reasons. Ultimately, that becomes money out. The important thing here to remember is that it's not sticky money.
In other words, it's not strong hand money.
It's
not
stable.
We talk about strong hands or weak hands. This is more like weak hand money where it's like it just flows right past the palm into the next palm.
Not a long-term allocation.
Yeah.
Now, so this is the contrast. What we've had is a change in character in terms of hot money in the marketplace. Now, instead of sort of that sophisticated money making a short-term commitment, you have, frankly, less sophisticated money making commitments with risks that are not fully appreciated.
Older, retired people who would normally just be in a CD.
Yep, but the primary criterion is cash flow. And the primary motivation is simply to improve income. And it's a necessity. Not able to make ends meet, looking at diminished returns on assets that you have at a bank or CD or treasury bills or what have you. Investors today need income and are willing to go anywhere to get it,
mm-hmm.
regardless of the changed risk profile. And that's really the tragedy here is that you've got REITs, you've got utilities, you've got dividend paying stocks, high yield bonds, junk bonds, all are now acting as substitutes for CDs and for money market balances. These are what we could call yield curve refugees. they're temporarily housed in products that meet immediate needs.
So, David, the key here is this is really changing the character of hot money. It's not sophisticated professional money. It's actually grandma and grandpa down the street who are trying to just get some income.
Yeah, and it's hot money, yes, fueled by loose monetary policies. No change there, really. But it's usually the professional investor community capitalizing on the availability of money and its cheap cost. Now what we're seeing is slightly different. We're seeing the consequence of the long duration of loose monetary policy.
Well, it's been years, Dave.
Yeah, so 5 years of low rates, and you've got a discouraged and hard-pressed group of savers that, again, due to these ridiculously low rates, whether it's in CDs or what have you, they're just simply looking for reasonable returns, and they're not finding them. So, yeah, maybe they're yield curve refugees or the CD refugees. They're now encamped in asset classes that are far higher in risk. And again, when risk is reappraised, this goes back to the Bank of Japan and the idea that if interest rates come up for any reason at all, you're going to see more volatility than you expected, in part because people have made allocations to these investments, not on the basis of wanting to own them, but on the basis of needing to own them, on the basis of needing income. And then all of a sudden, as the landscape changes, the reason or justification for owning them also changes, and there's a radical increase in volatility. Again, whether that's low volatility stocks or dividends or utility, this is what we're talking about, is we're now embedding a tremendous amount of volatility and risk into sort of generic blue chips. And this is a consequence of Fed policy and the long-term duration keeping low rates for so long.
Well, David, one of the ways they're keeping the rates so low for so long is they're basically borrowing from themselves. I mean, if our government actually had to go out and sell treasuries and not buy any back from themselves, they'd have to raise rates to a degree that people would be willing to take the risk. But, I mean, recently they're buying almost 3/4 of all of the treasuries that they're issuing right now.
Yeah, it's just when you look at interest rates today, it's a sign and symptom of a very distorted and very controlled market. I mean, yeah, 3/4 is right. Fed purchases up to 72% of new treasury issuance. And I've made mention of this before. Bloomberg ran an article out of the $770 billion in new treasury issuances. We see very healthy subscriptions and, you know, $3 in purchases for every dollar that's offered in demand. But lo and behold, it's the Fed who's showing up and saying, I'll take one, I'll take two, I'll take three.
Take those $3 for
exactly. Yeah. It's this crazy reality that doesn't represent risk, doesn't represent inflation expectations. I mean, again, all of these things have been muted and covered over by intervention, what is essentially a command economy.
Well, and David, you know, I'll tell you, it's not necessarily blind investors that are investing this way. There are a lot of people with their eyes wide open, and they're saying, you know what? I see the risk, but everybody around me is earning an income, and my only alternative is to sit in cash and not earn an income, so I better take the risk because I need it. So more and more, whether they're blind to the facts or whether they see the facts, people are being sucked into this way of thinking.
You know, it reminds me of hitting the golf course and riding around in the golf cart and sort of comparing notes. And this happens so commonly with investors today. You know, how you doing? Oh, yeah, well, the S&P's up 16%, doing really well. Meanwhile, the guy who's sheepish is either sitting in gold or cash and saying, well, you know, gold's down and cash isn't doing any good. Maybe I should be investing in equities.
Sure.
And it's this sort of social pressure that, again, goes back to the Bank of Japan and the Fed perpetuating this reality. And then all of a sudden, growth feeds on growth, and people start saying, well, you know, I missed it 1 year. I don't want to miss it a second year in a row. I don't want to be the man out in terms of the discussion as we tee off. You know, yeah, I'm just still sitting with 0% rates of return while my neighbor, my friend, my colleague is earning 12, 15, 30%, whatever it may be in the marketplace.
Right.
And so again, risk is sort of almost a perpetuating thing. Greed begins to become contagious.
Well, David, there are two things that seem to fuel a market. It's either greed or fear. Mm-hmm. And, you know, fear can be just as powerful of a feedback loop. In fact, maybe more.
But today you've got investors that are more and more of the belief that, just like in the Greenspan era, where you always had support for growth in the stock market, making basically the stock market a one-way bet, so too is Ben Bernanke.
Right.
So too is Mr. Kuruta. This is the reality. More people believe that they're safe making speculative bets, and thus become that much more bold because of the implied support from central banks. This sort of support proportionately increasing speculation and risk-taking.
Okay, Dave, as much as it hurts, let's pretend again like we're Ben Bernanke, though. Okay, we've got a challenge here. How in the world do you unwind this sense of dependency that we've created with low interest rates?
It's almost impossible because you've got the stock and real estate markets which resemble crack babies. I mean, dependent on a substance that does not promote normal or sustainable growth. That's the issue in play. You've got the two areas which are being championed as signs of a return to normalcy and growth in the economy, utterly dependent on the Fed's activity. Take away the Fed's activity, and you are going to see an impact when it comes to increasing interest rates in the mortgage-backed securities market. And, of course, the unintended consequences, as we were mentioning, not only in the industrial space, but anyone who has a leveraged balance sheet, just as in Japan, you find banks overexposed to the Japanese bond market, so too the U.S. banks also have massive fixed income portfolios. I mean, if you look at their balance sheets today, they don't keep very many private loans on the books. They prefer to leverage their balance sheet 10, 12 to 1 and be sitting in Ginnie Mae's, Sally Mae's, or 10, 15, 20-year treasuries. Again, just playing this borrowing short and investing long. But again, they're investing on a leveraged basis in assets that are interest rate sensitive. You've got our entire banking system, which is in fact leveraged and vulnerable. And the only reason that we maintain some stability over the next 3, 6, 12, 18 months in our bank system is because they don't have to mark those assets to market. They can hold them at whatever price they want, and the balance sheet does not have to reflect the volatility that they may experience as a result of an increase in interest rates. It doesn't change the fact that they would technically be bankrupt with the basis of an increase in interest rates.
Well, and it's interesting, going back to Japan, because a lot of Americans will listen and go, well, why would we be watching Japan? But, you know, the acceleration with what Abe is doing right now, he decided to just go ahead and double his money supply and double the monetary base in a two-year period. So what we're seeing, you know what it reminds me of, Dave? I just got my lawn fertilized, and it's got the stuff in there that kills the dandelions. And I remember reading how that works at one time. What it does is it accelerates the life process so quickly that it destroys the plant almost immediately. Well, in a way, we've got Abe doing the same type of thing. So it might be a microcosm of what we have coming in America later.
Well, exactly. The reason we should be watching Japan with great interest is because, just like the U.S., they are using monetary policy to absorb structural and macro imbalances. Mm-hmm. And problems have always emerged in the currency markets when liquidity is abused. I mean, that goes back to Paul Meissen's point of how you do see loose monetary policies impact banks, and ultimately a banking crisis can emerge. But when you take away gold standard and have a fiat money system, there's a direct transmission from a banking crisis to a currency crisis, and it's unavoidable. And from 1914 to the present, the instances, I mean, it's literally inescapable. If you have a banking crisis, you're going to have a currency crisis,
right?
Because you're talking about a failure of confidence, and it just passes through. And so, again, problems have always emerged in the currency markets. We care about the dollar. We care about the yen. When liquidity is abused, we have liquidity being abused as we speak, the Bank of Japan and the Fed, to an enormous degree.
You always have a crisis afterwards. Let me ask you a question, though, Dave. All right. As ironic as it is, we know how unfettered the dollar is to anything, all right? And we know that they've created trillions and trillions. But could we actually see a dollar rally here while Japan falls apart if they ruin the yen?
Yeah, I mean, if you had in a very short period of time an additional 20 to 40% decline in the value of the yen, you would see some sort of relative benefit, not on an absolute basis. Are we talking about strength in the U.S. dollar?
Right.
But on a relative basis, now you've got sort of the currency which is terminal and has been given the diagnosis of AIDS, but untreatable. Yes, then and only then would you see the dollar rally on a relative basis. But following that sort of temporary support for the dollar, we face the very same set of circumstances with currency decline, with the failure of confidence. And you have to keep in mind, failure of confidence in the dollar gets transmitted through to U.S.-denominated assets as well. Anyone on a foreign basis who's interested in owning U.S. assets is owning the U.S. asset in question, but it is in U.S. dollar terms. The dollar weakens. They question not only the currency, but the asset as well. That can be real estate. That can be the bond market. That can be the stock market. So there's a double whammy in terms of currency weakness and a critical point being in the currency market, when that point is reached, now it's just sell all U.S. assets, regardless of the asset quality in question.
Well, and to keep that from happening, I guess the Fed would need to dial down all interventions and risk from this point forward. I mean, they're going to have to scale back at some point. They're not going to probably do it. They'll talk as if they are, but they seem to just continue to add.
Well, if they don't dial down their current interventions, you're going to see a major inflationary trend. And yet, if they do dial down, this is where they're on the horns of a dilemma.
Right.
They risk the equity market and real estate market stability in doing so.
Mm-hmm.
So this is becoming a game of chosen winners and losers. And believe it or not, that's normal in a command economy.
A command economy like an Eastern European economy.
You're always choosing winners and losers, and
right.
That's what we have today, is the Fed choosing winners and losers.
So, David, you say command economy. We're no longer in a free market.
Well, and I think this is where, you know, going back to Jean-Claude Juncker's comment, when it becomes serious, you have to lie. This is what is farcical. This is where we have an imagined world of the free markets, where, in fact, we have controlled markets. The lie from the Fed is that we do have a free market today.
Mm-hmm.
Yet what we have today is price fixing in the two most important areas of our economy. Housing, obviously, is a huge part of our economy, very important. And the Treasury market, if we can't pay our bills, we have to issue IOUs, and there's an interest rate associated with those IOUs, and yet we are fixing the price of our bonds by fixing interest rates. That is an utter manipulation. It's a deception, if you will, in terms of real values, and it transmits its way all the way through every other asset class, signifying that we have stability in the marketplace when, in fact, it is nothing but a controlled, nothing but a sort of farcical market. So this brings us full circle to this notion that the Fed seems to not have an issue with a deception, with a lie, with a misrepresentation of reality, as long as the circumstances are serious enough. And that is where we are. We would not be talking about $85 billion worth of purchases, combination of mortgage-backed securities and treasuries, low interest rates, the Fed funds rate set at virtually zero for the amount of time that it has, if we were not in desperate circumstances to begin with. These are extraordinary measures, and yet the market is approaching this as if it's normal, healthy, and just temporary in nature.
Well, and I think of the progression of the way the original economics was written as far as Fed intervention and printing of money. They said, oh, we'll only do a little at a time. And then what happens is it leads to a little bit more, leads to a little bit more. So a little is good. They tell us even a little inflation is good. And then a little more, well, that's not too bad. And,
but, well, I grew up in a family that focused on health concerns. I mean, longevity issues. You know, my dad's in great shape. I mean, he's in his 70s, and I swear he is three times as strong as I am at a minimum. I mean, he can bench press easily three times what I can. And it's not like I'm a gangly weakling. By comparison, I am.
He has got a lot of energy.
But all this to say, health concerns, longevity issues. Yeah, these are issues that are on the family's mind. And I've often heard it said that if a little is good, a lot is better. So, I mean, we're talking about vitamin C and things like that, just as an example. But in monetary matters, you've got a little devaluation, which is perceived as good as well. And that's our sort of stated 2% rate of inflation. And a lot is obviously not better, but it may become inevitable.
Mm.
Right now, we're playing with the market's fickleness, and we're playing with risk. A mid-course reappraisal will lead to radical market volatility as a consequence. And that, I think, as we look back at last week's volatility in the Japanese markets, is a foreshadowing of the kind of volatility that we have in the U.S. markets with a reappraisal of risk and the market volatility that comes with it.
Well, and one of the things about volatility, Dave, is that, you know, you can't handle it if you're on margin. We've talked about this before. But, you know, I think about even the gold drop 5 or 6 weeks ago that we've been talking about. The people who really got hurt were the ones on margin. That's why 3,000 tons of gold had to be sold ultimately because of the margins. But for the person who's still out there investing wisely, let's talk about the triangle just for a moment before we wrap up. If a person has a balance of gold and silver and a balance of strong equities, and this person doesn't necessarily play the high price earnings ratio stocks, and then, you know, cash, even though cash is losing value right now, it still is something that's probably a whole lot better than getting out there and taking speculative risk. If a person is balancing that way, it seems like a strategy that will get them through better than a margined account in a speculative investment.
Well, what we really have today, and I think this is echoed by Deutsche Bank's co-chief executive, yeah, he says we may have good prospects for the global economy stabilizing in 2013, but he says that nonetheless, the highly optimistic mood in the financial markets indicates a risk that some market participants may be underestimating the fiscal policy difficulties in the U.S. and the consequences of the European debt crisis. That's what we see today, is underestimation of risk. And as that is reappraised, again, the kind of volatility we saw last week, but on a more global basis.
Well, you've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick, along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com. That's McIlvaney.com. Or give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.